Imagine you're the director of the Port of Rotterdam.
Right.
Right. So you're overseeing the largest seaport in Europe. It's this this sprawling industrial complex of steel and concrete and deep water.
Oh, yeah. A massive operation.
Exactly. And your job requires you to authorize these multi-billion dollar infrastructure projects today. Like, you are literally pouring concrete right now for shipping terminals that have to be fully operational and, you know, highly profitable in the year 2050.
Right. Which is, frankly, terrifying.
It is, because if you look at the global economy, I mean, predicting what's going to happen next year feels impossible, let alone in 2050. So you are essentially forced to navigate this massive financial ship while flying completely blind.
It's a really brutal position for any decision maker to be in, honestly. You can't just look at past data and draw a straight line into the future. I mean, that only works when the world is stable.
Right, which it isn't.
Exactly. Today, the fundamentals of the global economy are just, they're shifting beneath our feet.
Yeah. And usually when we face uncertainty, we like to think of it like a medical diagnosis. Like, you break your arm, the doctor looks at an x-ray, points to the jagged white line and says, you know, here's exactly what's wrong. But long-term strategic planning, it doesn't have an x-ray machine.
No, it doesn't. And researchers actually categorize this specific dilemma you're describing as level three uncertainty.
Level three.
Yeah, it's a distinct theoretical space. So level one and two uncertainty, those are situations where we can reasonably extrapolate from historical data.
Yeah.
We know the variables.
Okay, so just basic forecasting.
Right. And then on the far opposite end, you have level four, which is deep uncertainty. That's when the variables are just so chaotic, you throw your hands up, you look at an infinite number of wild scenarios, and just accept that you can't prepare for all of them.
I mean, that sounds exhausting. But level three is right in the middle then.
Precisely. We know the core systems of the world are fundamentally changing, so copying and pasting the past is out of the question. But we also have enough data that we shouldn't just be throwing darts at a board, you know?
We just need a way to organize the chaos, like a framework to process the overwhelming amount of noise we see in the headlines every day.
Yes, exactly.
And that is exactly what we're exploring today. Welcome to this deep dive into a really compelling theoretical model published in Futures Research Unpacked. It's by researchers Cornelis van Dorser and Poonam Taneja.
Right. Their paper is called An Integrated Three-Layered Foresight Framework.
Yeah. And essentially, they've proposed this master conceptual model that takes the unpredictable future and organizes it into three distinct layers of time. The core argument here is that not all future developments are equally uncertain.
I love this concept. Because if you look at the different speeds at which the world changes, you can actually spot the future just by tracking the sheer inertia of massive underlying trends.
Right. So our mission today is to unpack this framework. Because if you understand the varying speeds of change from century-long tectonic shifts all the way down to 10-year technological bursts, you can massively reduce the unpredictability of the future.
So let's figure out how this map works.
Yeah, let's get into it. So if we are trying to predict what technologies or industries will dominate, say, 20 years from now, it sounds like we can't actually start by looking at the technology itself. We have to zoom way, way out to the slowest, deepest forces shaping human history.
Right. The authors call this layer one.
The slow giants.
Yes. The top layer of this framework consists entirely of century-long trends. These are phenomena that have been moving in a consistent direction for over 100 years.
Wow, over a century.
Yeah, and because they've been building momentum for so long, they have incredible inertia. They are remarkably stable. And because of that stability, this is the one layer where we actually can use mindful extrapolation to predict the future.
Okay, so the paper outlines 10 of these massive century-long trends. But I want to look closely at a few of the most disruptive ones for you listening. One that stood out immediately is resource depletion, specifically regarding energy.
Oh, this is fascinating.
Yeah, the authors highlight a metric called EROI, which I had never even heard of before, but it completely changes how you look at the fossil fuel industry.
It really does. So EROI stands for Energy Return on Energy Invested. It measures a very simple but brutal physical reality. Like, how much energy do you have to burn in order to extract new energy from the earth?
Right.
Back in 1930, the EROI for fossil fuels was over 100.
Over 100?
Yeah. For every single barrel of oil's worth of energy you spent drilling, you got 100 barrels back. It was an absolute energy bonanza. And that funded the rapid expansion of the modern world.
So you basically barely had to scratch the surface of the earth and wealth just came pouring out.
Exactly. But all the easy, accessible oil is gone now. By 1970, new global discoveries had dropped to an EROI of below 8.
Below 8? That's a huge drop.
Yeah. And today, if you look at complex extraction methods like mining car sands, for example, the EROI is down to roughly 2 to 4.
Wait. So for every barrel of energy we burn to run the massive mining trucks and the processing plants and everything, we are only getting 2 to 4 barrels back.
Yes. You are expending massive amounts of energy just to squeeze a slightly larger margin of energy out of the rock.
That is insane.
I mean, this isn't just some environmental talking point. It is a fundamental, inescapable, physical limit on economic growth.
That is a slow giant, if I've ever seen one. It basically dictates that eventually, regardless of politics or policy, the math of fossil fuels simply stops working.
Exactly.
Another massive giant they track in layer one is demographics and geopolitics. Because we often hear about populations growing or shrinking, but the framework links this directly to a massive shift in global power.
Right, because population size is intrinsically linked to two things, economic output and military capacity.
Makes.
And the authors point out this stark, century-long divergence happening right now. Africa and the U.S. are projected to see continued population growth. But meanwhile, Europe's population is heavily stabilizing and projected to decline.
And China.
China is currently nearing its population peak and faces a substantial demographic cliff, while Russia is already in a state of severe demographic decline.
And as those populations shift, the geopolitical center of gravity just shifts right along with them.
Correct. The researchers note that these shifting demographics are slowly grinding away the unipolar dominance of the U.S. It's pushing us toward a bipolar or even a multipolar world order.
Right. You can see the institutional friction this creates, right? Between established Western alliances like NATO and rising Eastern coalitions like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
Exactly. Yeah. These aren't just sudden political spats. They're the result of century-long demographic tectonic plates literally colliding.
It's so wild to think about it on that scale. And speaking of long-term friction, there's another layer one trend that caught my eye, secularization and individualization. The text notes this really fascinating historical contrast that actually explains a lot of modern supply chain disruptions.
Yeah, this is a great example of the framework in action.
Right. So in the West, secularization was this gradual bottom-up process. It unfolded over several centuries.
Mm-hmm.
But the authors point out that in parts of the Middle East, specifically back in the 1920s, there were these sudden top-down attempts by governments to enforce secularization almost overnight.
Heavily influenced by Western ideology, yeah.
Exactly. And just to be clear for you listening, we're not taking any political sides here. We're just neutrally reporting the sociological cause and effect that the authors describe in the paper.
Right. And this is a perfect example of how the framework requires us to look at the mechanisms of cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you force a massive cultural shift from the top down, rather than letting it evolve naturally over centuries, you violently disenfranchise huge segments of the population.
Yeah.
The authors argue that this abrupt policy decision in the 1920s created decades of just simmering resentment.
Which eventually boils over.
Exactly. That historical friction is a root cause of the regional instability and geopolitical tensions we see in those areas today. And if we follow the causal chain, that instability directly threatens global shipping lanes and, you know, fuels mass migration.
And then that migration puts pressure on Western borders.
Right. Which in turn acts as a catalyst for modern populism and anti-globalization movements in Europe and the U.S.
So a top-down cultural policy from literally 100 years ago is rippling through time to cause logistical bottlenecks at shipping ports today.
It's wild, but yeah. That's the sheer inertia of these layer one trends. They don't just happen and end. They echo for generations.
But I have to ask, do these deep ocean currents ever actually break? Like, can a century-long trend just suddenly reverse?
They do bend, but they bend incredibly slowly. They do not snap overnight. Think of these century-long trends as the overarching boundaries of our reality.
Mm.
They don't tell us exactly what specific technology will be invented tomorrow. But they absolutely dictate what problems society must solve next.
I see.
Like, the dropping EROI of fossil fuels demands that we invent new energy systems.
Yeah.
Aging demographics demand that we figure out how to maintain economic output with far fewer workers.
Okay, so if the century-long trends are the deep boundaries telling us we are running out of cheap energy and young workers, how does society actually mobilize to fix that? I mean, we don't just wake up one Tuesday and globally agree to overhaul our entire infrastructure. There has to be a mechanism for that transition, right?
You're right. And that brings us to layer two of the framework. the engine of change.
The engine of change.
Yeah. To understand this, we have to look at how society handles massive systemic transitions. And the primary mechanism researchers track here is the Kondratiev wave, or K wave.
The K wave, I mean, it sounds like a surfing term, but this actually comes from a Russian economist in the 1920s, Nikolai Kondratiev. What exactly is it?
So a K wave is a macroeconomic supercycle that lasts roughly 50 years.
50 years.
Yeah. Ever since the Industrial Revolution, researchers have observed these distinct 50-year waves of economic boom, peak, recession, and recovery.
But why 50 years? Like, what is the actual mechanism driving that specific timeline?
It fundamentally comes down to human lifespans
and
the life cycle of physical infrastructure.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When a new suite of technologies is introduced, say, the automobile or the internet, it takes about a generation to build all the factories, the roads, the fiber optic cables required to really maximize it.
Right. That's the boom.
But eventually that infrastructure gets old. It saturates the market.
The returns start to diminish.
Exactly. But the people running those industries, you know, the executives and politicians who built their entire careers on that paradigm, they don't want to let it go. They resist change.
Of course they do.
So it takes another generation for those legacy industries to rust out, for that older generation to retire, and for massive capital investments to finally give up on the old paradigm and start funding the next one.
That whole process of birth, maturity, resistance, and replacement takes about half a century.
Yeah, that's the 50-year timer.
That makes perfect sense. And what's crucial to this framework is that each of these 50-year K waves is driven by a pervasive socio-techno-economic paradigm, like a specific set of technologies and social behaviors that completely dominate that half century.
Exactly.
For instance, the authors note that the fifth K wave, which peaked in the early 2000s, was entirely driven by globalization and ICT information and communication technology.
Right. Think about what defined the last 50 years, the massive unprecedented expansion of global supply chains, the creation of the internet, global telecommunications. That was the engine of the fifth K wave.
But according to the historical data, that wave has already peaked, and it's been in its natural downswing phase.
Which means the old infrastructure is rusting out, and we are standing right on the precipice of the 6K wave.
And the framework projects that the massive upswing of this next 50-year cycle begins somewhere between 2027 and 2036.
Yes. And its primary drivers will be sustainability and IoT, the Internet of Things, or hyperconnectivity.
Okay, so the crises created by the end of the fifth wave, environmental degradation, supply chain vulnerabilities, that dropping EROI for fossil fuels we talked about, they require a completely new paradigm.
Exactly. The sixth wave will be defined by merging digital connectivity with physical sustainability.
But wait, a rigid 50-year cycle sounds almost suspiciously exact? I mean, human history doesn't run on a strict stopwatch. Are these waves guaranteed to happen right on schedule?
That is a very important distinction to make. The framework models human systems, and human decisions can distort the timeline.
So we can mess it up.
Oh, definitely. The sequence of the wave is highly reliable. You always go from boom to bust to recovery, but massive geopolitical events can stretch or compress the timer.
The paper actually gives a really clear historical example of this. World War II happened entirely out of sequence.
Yes, it did.
It occurred during what should have been a recovery phase of a K wave, rather than the typical tension phase that usually precipitates a conflict. And the authors trace this back to the Versailles Treaty after World War I.
Right. The treaty placed mathematically impossible restitution demands on the Weimar Republic. It forced Germany to pay debts it couldn't possibly afford.
Which caused hyperinflation, wiped out the middle class, and led to societal collapse.
Precisely. That artificial economic pressure accelerated the radicalization of the population. It essentially bypassed the natural economic recovery phase and forced a premature crisis.
Throwing the entire global K-wave off its natural rhythm.
Yeah. It's a sobering reminder that while trends are powerful, human policy choices can severely disrupt them.
So we have the slow 100-year boundaries of layer one setting the rules and the 50-year societal timeline of layer two deciding when we transition.
Right.
But what about the stuff we actually read about in the news every day? Where do things like artificial intelligence, 3D printing, and self-driving cars fit into this?
That brings us to the bottom of the framework, layer three, the megatrends.
Okay.
These are specific technological and societal trends that last roughly 10 to 30 years.
Now, the real genius of this paper isn't just that it lists these three separate layers of time. It's how it shows them interacting. It's this massive meta framework of feedback loops. I actually like to think of it like a combination lock.
Oh, I like that. How so?
Well, the century-long trends of Layer 1, like the physical reality of climate change and dropping EROI, they are the first turn of the dial.
Right.
They trigger the necessity of the next K-wave. They act as the pressure saying, we need a sustainable paradigm or the economy collapses. That's the first number.
I see. And then the 50-year K-waves are the second turn of the dial because they dictate the timing of the megatrends.
Exactly. And this completely changed how I view current technology. Like, we have highly capable AI right now. We have advanced 3D printing right now. You might look around and think they are the current dominant paradigm, but the framework says no, they aren't. Not yet.
Right. Because historical data shows that major world-changing innovations are almost always born during the downswing of a Kondratiev wave, when the old system is failing and people are desperate for solutions.
Oh, wow.
But those technologies don't actually become the unquestioned dominant foundation of society until the upswing of the next wave fully matures.
So AI and 3D printing are basically in their economic infancy right now.
Yes.
The framework tells us they won't truly reach maturity and reorganize the entire global economy until the sixth K wave hits its stride around the year 2040.
And then the third turn of the combination lock clicks into place. Because the megatrends happening right now, they confirm the K-wave.
Right. When we see billions of dollars suddenly flowing into smart grids, decentralized energy, and the Internet of Things, it validates that the six K-wave's drivers really are sustainability and hyperconnectivity.
You need the whole lock. If you just look at a new solar panel or a new AI model in isolation, you're just guessing at its impact.
Yeah, it's just noise.
But if you see it as the final number clicking into place after a 100-year resource shift and a 50-year economic cycle, you actually understand the mechanics of the future.
You've just described exactly how this framework reduces epistemic uncertainty.
Yep.
Epistemic uncertainty. Is that just a fancy academic term for not knowing what's going to happen?
Essentially, yes. But specifically, epistemic uncertainty refers to uncertainty that exists simply because we lack knowledge or a proper model to understand a situation, as opposed to uncertainty caused by true random chaos.
Okay, I see.
By using this combination lock of time layers, we gain structural knowledge. We remove the epistemic blinders.
Okay, a theoretical combination lock is great for a white paper, but I want to test this on actual steel and concrete.
Let's do it.
Let's go back to the scenario we started with. The researchers actually applied this exact three-layered framework to the port of Rotterdam to help map out their survival strategy for 2040.
And when you apply the rigid logic of the framework to a physical space like a seaport, the threats become incredibly stark.
Terrifying is the word I'd use. I mean, the port realizes that because of the 100-year trend towards sustainability and the K-wave shifting away from fossil fuels, they stand to lose up to 50% of their current cargo volume.
Imagine being the director and realizing half of your physical footprint is dedicated to an industry that is structurally doomed over the next two decades.
The oil terminals, the coal storage, it's all going to decline.
And it's not just energy either.
Right. The framework predicts that deep sea container transport, you know, bringing cheap manufactured goods from Asia to Europe, is going to stagnate.
Yep.
Why? Because the layer one demographics show Europe's population is aging and shrinking, which means a massive drop in consumption.
And then you add to that the layer three megatrend of 3D printing and advanced robotics, which means goods will increasingly be manufactured locally in Europe rather than shipped across an ocean.
So the deep ocean currents and the economic waves are crashing directly against the port's existing 20th century business model.
But the framework doesn't just predict doom. It dictates the pivot.
Exactly. The port has to transition. And they must align their physical infrastructure with the drivers of the sixth K wave.
Right. The researchers detail how the port is using a massive newly reclaimed area of land out in the North Sea called the Second Maasvlakte. And they're repurposing the space left behind by dying fossil fuel companies.
And the new industries they are targeting are fascinating. Like, they are moving heavily into biobulk.
Biobulk is essentially organic, plant-based raw materials that will replace petroleum in the manufacturing of plastics and chemicals.
Right. They are also clearing space for synthetic fuels, specifically mentioning hydrogen and formic acid.
Which is brilliant, because pure hydrogen is incredibly difficult and dangerous to transport.
Yeah, it's super volatile.
But if you convert it into formic acid, it becomes a stable liquid at room temperature. It's a necessary technological stepping stone for a sustainable global energy trade.
Wow. They are also planning to serve as the primary offshore supply base for massive wind and solar farms in the North Sea. And here's one detail that really surprised me. They are actively planning to introduce offshore aquaculture large-scale fish farming, right into the port's surrounding waters.
It sounds strange for a shipping port. Right. But if you look at the Layer 1 trends, climate change is heavily stressing traditional land-based agriculture.
Right.
While global populations in other regions continue to grow, alternative industrialized food sources will be an absolute necessity.
So the port is transitioning from just moving things to actually producing sustenance.
Exactly.
But wait, let me play devil's advocate here for a second. If the framework tells us that the real maturity of the sixth K wave isn't going to dominate until the late 2030s or 2040, why does the port need to panic and pour concrete right now? Why not just wait until 2035 to start building the hydrogen plants?
Because of physical inertia. You cannot simply flip a switch and turn a massive toxic petrochemical cluster into a pristine synthetic hydrogen facility overnight. The existing fossil fuel companies won't vacate immediately. Their decline will be a slow, drawn-out process over decades.
Ah, so you need the physical space right now to prototype the future while the past is still operating next door.
Exactly. The port must foster the evolutionary transition of these new sustainable industries today. It takes years to build the infrastructure, train the workforce, and establish the new supply chains.
If they wait for the sixth wave to peak before they start building, the wave will simply crash over them.
Yeah. They have to start paddling today to catch the ride by 2040.
That makes the theory so tangible. You literally have to bulldoze physical space today for a theoretical economic wave that won't peak for 20 years. Because if you don't, you won't survive the transition.
It perfectly illustrates the immense value of Van Dorsser and Tanasia's model. It doesn't give you a magic crystal ball.
Right.
You still don't know exactly what the specific hydrogen reactor will look like in 2040, but it gives you the structure of time.
It takes isolated, noisy news items, a breakthrough in solar panels here, a demographic report from China there, and places them into a coherent blueprint.
You suddenly understand why things are happening and roughly when they will matter.
Now, we should acknowledge that elaborating on these trends is inherently subjective. The authors note that predicting exactly how a global K-wave trickles down to affect a specific local industry requires deep subject matter expertise.
Right. Two different port directors might interpret the timing of a transition slightly differently.
Yes, the interpretation is an art informed by science. The framework is a tool for strategic navigation, not an immutable law of physics.
But if you are that executive trying to build for 2050, this framework tells you that while you cannot predict the daily weather 10 years from now, you can definitively understand the changing of the seasons.
I love that analogy. You can see the long winter of fossil fuels ending, and you know the spring of digital sustainability is beginning.
And that profound perspective is what allows you to act with conviction, even when surrounded by level 3 uncertainty.
I want to leave you with a final, provocative thought directly inspired by this framework. It's something the authors touched on regarding those century-long trends, and it's a tension we haven't fully resolved. The fundamental equation of modern economic growth relies on a very simple premise. You need an ever-expanding working-age population to invent new technologies, build new infrastructure, and consume new products.
More people equals more output. It has been the baseline assumption of global economics for three centuries.
Right. But as we discussed, the demographic data shows that populations in major economic engines like Europe and China are heavily stabilizing or facing sharp declines. So here's the question for you to mull over. What happens when the unstoppable force of three centuries of expected perpetual economic growth finally hits the immovable object of global population decline?
That's the huge question.
Will the next century-long trend we experience be the fundamental end of economic growth as we have defined it since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution? I mean, how does human society function if the line stops going up and to the right?
It is the ultimate structural tension of our time.
Just something to think about the next time you hear a politician or an economist making a confident 30-year forecast. The X-ray machine might be useless, but at least now we have a map to navigate the muddy waters.